Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we feature essays about life from students at University Laboratory High School in Urbana, talk to the man behind the mannequin's comic strip, and we get some advice on what it takes to be a good crime fighter from the authors of The Government Manual for New Superheroes. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Throughout the show, we'll be featuring essays from four seniors who attend University Laboratory High School in Urbana. These essays were part of Barb Ridenour's Introduction to Radio class. The students were asked to think about something they thought was important, something that was on their mind, something they would like others to know about. Our first essay comes from Stephen Buzard. It's about jazz and one of that genre's most important figures.
I am a classical musician. I worry about right notes. Everything I play is written out, often unchanged for hundreds of years. There is something very precise and intellectual about so-called legit music, don't get me wrong. I will always love classical music, but recently I've discovered a new love for jazz. One of my friends got a copy of the Miles Davis album, The Birth of the Cool, and suggested that I listen to it. I was a bit skeptical at first, not knowing what to expect from titles like Boplicity and Butto. I was also a bit confused by the instrumentation. Rhythm, saxes, trumpet, trombone, French horn, and tuba. I eventually got around to listening to the recording, and it totally changed my outlook on jazz. My impression of jazz had always been that you go through a tune altogether, then improvise long, shapeless solos for 10 minutes and play the tune again. This was not the case here. There were no heads and choruses. The composers utilized classical elements like counterpoint and form, and the tunes were not recycled melodies from the 20s. No, this was something different. But the best thing about this album is when Miles Davis solos. My previous impression of jazz improvisation was that it was an ego-driven means of playing as many high and fast notes as humanly possible within 12 bars. But after the first note of his first solo on the album, Miles utterly destroyed these notions. What makes Miles' improv so great is that he cannot play as fast or as high as other players. Instead, his gift is lyricism, shape, and zen. His solos all have something to say, something that could not be expressed by anyone but him. He improvises as a way of communicating, not of showing off. Miles has taught me something about legit music, too. Often we classical musicians get too wrapped up in playing the right notes. We get so obsessed with playing exactly what some guy wrote 300 years ago, that we forget to put a little of ourselves in the music, too. Whenever Miles plays, you know it comes from the soul, from the very first note, and that's what makes him such a compelling musician. Sure, the notes themselves are important, particularly in classical music, but there needs to be something more. It needs spirit.
That essay comes from Stephen Buzard, a senior at University Laboratory High School in Urbana. We'll be featuring more essays from students throughout the show. This is Sidetrack. Local comic strip artist Don Chambers has recently released the second collection of his strip mannequins. It's titled Mannequins Rocks Southern England and the Midwestern United States. It's published by Soybean Farm Press. I talk with Chambers about the new book, the comic strip, and how it's all put together. Well, in the spirit of full disclosure, we want to let people know that besides doing this comic strip, you also work here for WILL in the art department.
That's correct.
Now, this is your second mannequins book, right?
That's right.
So describe the comic strip for us. Who are the characters? What's it about? That sort of general stuff.
I have several characters. They're all in their early to mid-20s, just going through life as best as they can, roughly based on acquaintances that I've known in the past. Just kind of conglomerate of people. They aren't really based on any one person, but just experiences that I've had.
And there's a guy who lives in a tank, and there's a pig who likes
That's
cars.
Correct. Yeah, it's a little bit of redneck humor, but...
So these comics aren't drawn in the traditional pen and ink way. These are all computer generated.
Yes, they're completely computer generated. And the clothes, the characters, the hair, everything.
Well, how does that work?
Well, sometimes it works well. Sometimes it's kind of a challenge. It's really interesting how I do it to get the textures for everything. I actually put the clothing on a flatbed scanner and scan it and wrap it around the images. For the hair, I take photographs of actual hair and scan that in and map that onto the 3D hair of the characters. So there's really a lot of work involved to it. At times it would be, you know, maybe better and a little easier to just draw them by hand, but at the same time, this way I can get a lot more perspective and a lot more depth and feeling to the comic strip and the characters themselves.
Now, did you ever do the pen and ink stuff, or did you always say, I want to experiment with the computer stuff?
Oh, I've been doing the pen and ink stuff ever since I was in grade school. I've loved it, and I got a chance to meet Charles Schulz, and he was an influence from the time I was in grade school. And when the Mac came out in the 1980s, I started to learn on that, and things just took off from there.
Now, this book, this current book, Mannequins Rocks Southern England and the Midwestern United States, it's not just a collection of the comic strip. It's also sort of a travelogue as well.
That's correct. The background images for the comic strip are actual photographs that I have taken on my travels, and a few of them I've acquired from various travel agencies. But that way, it adds interest to the strip. I've had a lot of comments. People say, oh, I saw you were in, your background picture was in Arthur today or in Decatur last week. And that seems to add quite a bit of interest.
And how does that incorporate into the sort of the stories, the ongoing comic strip itself?
Sometimes they relate to what the background image is. Sometimes it's just, they're just there and it's just to add interest.
But, I mean, you always you talk about the different spots that you go. You have a little blurb about each different location and then a
right.
comic strip.
That's basically just to add interest to the book and to give people a little bit more of a hand about where the characters have been and where I've been and just a kind of a marketing tool as well.
The introduction of this book was written by Mort Walker, the guy who
That's correct.
Brings us Beetle Bailey each and every day.
That's correct, and he also was the co-creator of High and Lois. I met him back in 1994, and I've kept up a little bit of correspondence with him, and he actually called me up a couple times to talk about the introduction, and he mentioned how much he liked the strip and thought that I should contact the syndicates about it, and he's just a super nice person, very helpful. Could see a little bit of Beetle Bailey in him, and it was just a fun experience. And I felt very honored that he thought enough about my work to be able to write the introduction for me.
Yeah, it's a really nice introduction. And he seems like one of these guys who generally wants to help out up-and-coming artists, you know, get their comic strips out there to the masses.
Oh, he does. He's very involved. He is the founder of the International Museum of Cartoon Art as well, which is currently located in the Empire State Building. Anything he can do to help aspiring cartoonists or, you know, even the more well-established cartoonists, he's right in there with it. And he's been past president of the National Cartoonist Society. He's very involved.
So what's next for you and the Mannequins comic strip?
Well, we just keep on rolling as best as we can, kind of go from week to week and just see what happens with the characters. This year will be the 10th year that it's been published in the Arthur Graphic Clarion in Arthur, Illinois, and it's been in a few other papers, and as I have time and a little more money, we'd like to see it in several more newspapers.
Well, if people want to find out about the current book, Mannequins Rock Southern England and the Midwestern United States, where can they find out more about it? Where can they go to get a copy?
They can check out the website at soybeanfarm.com, and they can also purchase a copy at Pages for All Ages in Savoy, at Borders in Champaign, and at down in Arthur at the Amish Country Kitchen.
Well, Don, thanks for joining us today, and thanks for talking about your comic strip, Mannequins.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, Jason.
That was Don Chambers talking about the latest collection of his comic strip, Mannequins Rocks Southern England and the Midwestern United States. It's published by Soybean Farm Press. You're listening to Sidetrack. Dracula and a candidate for governor of Minnesota have something in common. They're both vampires. Amy Guida sees some possible legal and political conflicts in this commentary.
You'd think that a vampire would make a lousy government official. The professions couldn't be more different. One sucks like a parasite on unsuspecting victims, and the other, well, never mind. Okay, aside from what some might see as similarities, indeed, clashes have occurred when vampires have tried to find their place within government-run institutions. For example, many a vampire has failed in his appeals to the courts. Judges don't seem to take too kindly to the devil-made-me-do-it defense. And government-run prison isn't all that accommodating either. Take the case of the vampire inmate in Utah who sued when the Department of Corrections refused to place him on a vampire diet. The case didn't say what the special nutrition request was, but I think we all know, and the court dismissed the vampire's case as totally frivolous. Rightly so. The warden sticks his neck out on that one, and pretty soon he finds that he's got to keep the prison shades drawn during daylight hours, and garlic's on the forbidden foodstuffs list, right up there with home-baked cakes. So what's with the vampire who's thrown his bat into the ring and wishes to become the next governor of Minnesota? Jonathan Sharkey says that he's a vampire in the practicing sense of that word, and that he'd be good for the Star of the North. He's tough on crime, supportive of veterans groups, concerned about farmers, and against drunk driving. Oh, and he promises to impale any terrorist on the grounds of the state capitol building. His nickname's the Impaler, you see. But in a land where the people have decided that the state beverage is milk, and the state muffin is blueberry, and the state flower is the pink and white lady slipper, it doesn't seem likely that voters would elect a vampire their governor. Not only is there an obvious incongruity in a vampire leading wholesome Minnesota, it just doesn't make good political sense. The first time some grave problem came up, no one would dare cross a vampire, literally or figuratively. Would any bill he supported go undead in committee? And would that be a good thing or a bad thing? How can there be a system of checks and balances when, according to Bram Stoker, a vampire can direct all the elements and command all the meaner things? Not to mention the issue of the name of the capital city, St. Paul. Minnesota's constitution, though, takes all comers. It lays out broad qualifications for governor. The governor shall have attained the age of 25 years and shall have been a bona fide resident of the state for 1 year next preceding his election, and shall be a citizen of the United States. No one thought to put a vampire clause in there. No one thought to put a professional wrestler clause in there either. But there's one clear problem for this particular vampire should he be elected. Minnesota law requires that the state's highest official declare annually one day as a day of solemn and public thanksgiving to Almighty God for blessings to the people. The Impaler's already come out, in the strongest way possible, against God. So given that sort of honesty, I predict that Jonathan Sharkey will not someday lead the great state of Minnesota. But don't breathe too easy yet. He says that he's also got his eye on the presidency. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois. You're tuned to Sidetrack. Sex education and how and what to teach is a complicated subject that high school students, parents, teachers, and administrators have to deal with constantly. University Laboratory High School senior Ben Erickson shares his opinion in this essay.
My sex education was disappointing at best. The current climate for sex ed in schools seems to follow a very disturbing trend throughout our nation. Our classes are often taught by adults who either aren't comfortable with the job or aren't properly educated on the subject matter. Questions, should the student gather the courage to ask them, are often ignored or answered inadequately. Abstinence is offered as, quote, the only way to prevent pregnancy and the spread of STIs, end quote, with no explanation of what exactly abstinence is, or if there are other ways to at least make sex safer. I can't help but feel insulted. My peers and I are being denied accurate information. Information that could shape our entire futures. Not providing comprehensive sex ed in schools leaves adolescents in a very awkward position. Most teens aren't entirely comfortable talking to their parents about sex. And for that matter, most parents aren't comfortable talking to their kids. And even in the rare case where both the parent and child are comfortable having a dialogue about sex, odds are the parent isn't going to have all the answers. At best, they wouldn't have entirely up-to-date information. At worst, they would feed the teen even more misinformation. This leaves the teen with no one to comfortably talk to about sex but each other, which is hardly enough in terms of education. Without some sort of authority on sexual health, teens are left almost completely in the dark, forced to figure things out on their own. While sometimes it's easiest to let teens learn from their mistakes, when the mistake results in a pregnancy or an STI, it can be life-altering. Teens need and deserve comprehensive sex ed in school. Assuming that we don't is both absurd and incredibly dangerous. By graduation, around half of high school students have been sexually active, and without reliable information at their disposal, it's increasingly likely that they weren't as safe about it as they should have been. This is an issue of human rights. People, regardless of age, deserve access to information on how to keep themselves healthy. Denying teens information on how to maintain their sexual health is both naive and inconsiderate, whereas helping them keep themselves safe can only provide a better future.
Ben Erickson, a senior from University Laboratory High School. We'll have more essays later on in the show. This is Sidetrack. The Merwin Gallery at Illinois Wesleyan University in Bloomington is currently exhibiting works that illustrate an artist's transformation. Laura Kennedy has the story.
Artist Ian Crawley says he's pleasantly surprised at the path his work has taken over the years. That route is illustrated in his latest show, Immaterial, A Journey. The exhibit is a sampling of the past decade and shows the growth of an artist moving from two-dimensional art to sculpture. Although he studied to be a graphic designer, Crawley allowed his imagination to lead him from working with ink, graphite, and scratchboard to investigating mark-making. He also drew from literature, particularly existentialists like Hesse, Camus, and Sartre, who used descriptions of everyday materials to describe something bigger than themselves.
So in that way, I started to explore the use of more kind of mundane materials like nails and wire, and that in turn kind of led me into what you see here today, into sticks and stones and dirt and grass, stuff that we largely kind of take for granted, that we see around for every day and really doesn't have much significance. And in that way, almost kind of immaterial. But it's almost a play on the words, where it's immaterial, it doesn't mean anything, but it means everything.
It's not unusual for artists to move between disciplines. But more unusual is Crawley's origins as a graphic artist, according to Illinois State University art professor Dennis French.
I think the fact that Ian was formally trained as a graphic designer and segued into sculpture, that was a really amazing move because he's not formally trained. So it was all intuitive. And I would have to say that the intuition is just sublime.
Merwin Gallery curator Jennifer Lapham says this type of exhibit gives us a rare look into the progress of an artist who uses previous techniques to work in a new medium.
One of the things for me that really stands out about this show is the strength of Ian's investigation as an artist and his ongoing investigations with material and form and how that's manifest in the mark making of the drawings and the use of the twigs in the sculpture.
One work in particular shows Crawley's work in transition from drawing to sculpture. I Am Everywhere includes both mark-making and sculpture, and it was the hardware store that gave Crawley his supplies, nails.
When I initially started the idea, I wanted to use the pointed end of the nail. So when I'd driven it through the board, I wanted the point of the nail to describe the face or the body. What I discovered very quickly, though, once I started to do it, was the nail head gave a tonal value. And depending how much you drove it in and the thickness of the nail head, it basically cast a shadow and created this tone. And so instead of actually creating a very sharp, pointed image, I discovered I could actually draw with nails and actually created very soft, diffused.
Art professor Dennis French says he could see the process Crawley was going through as an artist when he glimpsed at Crawley's sketchbooks a few years ago and noticed how the marks in the book signaled a transition to the sculpture work.
That's how many 2D artists really work, is through a series of marks in kind of an organizational sense. And he made the leap to sculpture in the same way. And using the materials as he did, the materials became marks to delineate the form of the sculpture. And it was amazing.
London-born and bred Crawley is making his mark these days with material he's found in his own Bloomington backyard. Sticks, moss, stones, and more help make up some examples from a larger body of work called God's Prototype, The Nature of Man, and they're prominently featured in the current exhibit.
Basically, it was the seventh day. It was a wet Sunday afternoon. God should be resting, but he can't sit still. And he's sitting in the Garden of Eden and comes up with the first concept of the human being. So based on that premise, I myself took up the gauntlet and think, okay, if you're going to create the first human being, how would this go about? And so after becoming familiar with some of these materials, I literally took those and produced most of the organs of the human body, and then into full-scale figure of the skeleton, the muscles, and the nervous system, and then finally the body.
Crawley says some of the materials themselves clearly stood out for what organ they should represent. For example, the brain is mostly made up of peach pits, which actually physically resembles the brain.
They're a seed, they're something where an idea germinates, and it just seemed only fitting that I make use of, basically there's peach pits, apple seeds, and plum pits that go to make up the brain. And I think I was kind of happy the way it worked out, and it kind of correlates both visually and also conceptually to what the brain is for the human being and what the seed is to the fruit.
As Crawley has moved from pen and paper, curator Jennifer Lapham says she's impressed with his new choices of material.
There's something primeval about the forms and the materials and the way that they're used, and yet it's totally of the moment as well. No matter how contemporary society becomes, we all live and die in the corporeal world.
Crawley says he's staying with sculpture for the foreseeable future. He's contemplating a new body of work focusing on paths, ladders, and footprints, still using the natural materials. He says his own path as an artist still surprises him.
This journey myself, you know, has been a very unexpected journey. I never imagined I'd be working in the materials that I'm working in now, or that I'd have gone from drawing into painting into sculpture so quickly.
Crawley says he hopes those viewing Immaterial: A Journey will see the connections between his earlier and most recent works, and perhaps walk away from the show with a greater appreciation for the small and insignificant things around us, realizing that maybe they're not so insignificant. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Immaterial: A Journey is at the Merwin Gallery in Bloomington through next Thursday. Still to come on the program, more essays from students from University Laboratory High School and the government manual for new superheroes. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack.
I hate essays.
An essay about essays from Maciek Swyg.
I've come to realization of this during the course of my education. Every year, my repertoire of essays written grows in a seemingly exponential fashion. We constantly reinforce the view that essays are good. They make you develop your writing skills, and this may very well be true. But what is the practical purpose of an essay? For that matter, what is the practical purpose of devoting your whole life to learning? It seems like such an out-of-place question, but I believe that it is one we have to consider, especially now that our technologies are growing at such a fast rate. But this is not a criticism of knowledge. I am not an advocate of anarchy. I do not believe that we should give up learning new things, because new technologies can and do help people all over the world. What I do believe is that we put too much of an emphasis on learning as much as we can. People spend their entire lives simply gathering more and more information, without ever realizing what really matters most in life. We see life as the endless search for more knowledge, which tends to have a negative effect on one's social capabilities. I believe that we were put on this earth to live good lives, to share our talents with each other. One of the ways of doing that is finding new technologies to better the lives of people, and if there is learning required for that, then I embrace it. But learning for learning's sake is something that I do not approve of. Also, I have come to the realization that so many of the things we might think we need, such as cell phones or MP3 players, are not really vital. In fact, in some cases, these objects are the cause of our worries and anxieties. Consider the life of a simple person. They have a house. All their absolute necessities are fulfilled. They make enough money to sustain a healthy lifestyle. Very possibly they have a group of friends that they can interact with. I would argue that this person is happier than an upper-middle-class person living in a big house with luxuries aplenty. There seems to be something about human nature that, once a person has started to appropriate luxuries, that person wants more and more of those. The simple person, however, has everything they need. Turns out that, for me at least, relationships with other people, especially friendships, are at the core of happiness. I derive much more happiness from spending an hour with one of my good friends than from buying myself some sort of new object that I had thought was necessary for my well-being. I believe that it is this sort of real happiness which humans should strive for, not for the constructed materialistic view. Perhaps when we are able to understand this, we will also learn to understand each other. Perhaps through this understanding, we will be able to create a more peaceful world. It's like Gandhi said, "You must be the change you want to see in the world." So why do I hate essays? because they symbolize all the learning for learning's sake. If you really want to help people, don't write an essay about it. Go do it.
That was Maciek Swajk, another student from University Laboratory High School in Urbana. We're featuring student essays throughout the program. You got attuned to Sidetrack, a collaboration between the University of Illinois' English department and its School of Art and Design is barely 2 years old, yet its work has already garnered national attention. The two departments joined up in 2004 to begin the publication of an experimental literary magazine consisting of poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and fine art. Late last year, and 4 issues later, the staff of Ninth Letter learned that their publication was named Best New Literary Journal by the Council of Editors of Learned Journals. Jeff Bosser talked with the editor of Ninth Letter, Jody Stanley, about the staff's vision for the publication and how others like it have already learned from it.
The journal was germinated the idea in the graduate writing program in the English department at the U of I, and it was the program's first year, and a group of graduate students and faculty found that they had a common interest in starting a literary journal. And so these students and faculty got together and sort of came up with the idea, drafted a proposal, took it to the chancellor, who at that time was Nancy Cantor, and she was very interested in the idea and helped by giving some seed money to start the journal. And at that point, then they got they did a nationwide search for an editor to come in and sort of run the journal, and that's when I came in. And then a few months after I got here, we put out our first issue.
And tell me about either the focus that you wanted to instill or maybe what they kind of their idea they had when you were brought aboard.
The focus of the magazine has always been on, obviously it's a literary magazine, so it was always intended to feature the best stories, poems, and essays that could be found. But to go into it into a little more detail, everyone seemed to have a common interest in exploring the connections that can be made between and among different pieces of writing. A lot of literary journals sort of they just publish pieces that are they just sort of present them out there and don't really look for any kind of connections among the different pieces that you find. But what we've been able to do because of our collaboration with Art and Design is to gather a bunch of pieces together and then to look at them as a whole collection. So each issue we kind of envision as a kind of little anthology or collection that we don't intend for it to be a theme issue. That is, we don't look for pieces with a common theme. But once we get pieces, then we look for kind of universal themes that keep cropping up. And we try to highlight that a little bit in terms of design. So that was one of the founding ideas of Ninth Letter. And that's one of the things that I found very interesting about the project when I first interviewed for the job. I was very excited to work with these people because I thought that was something that I hadn't seen happening in literary magazines before.
A better coordination between different departments like you have in design. It's interpreted differently from one person to the next.
Right, right. So that's, I mean, everything can be interpreted differently, which is one of the great things about literature is that there are so many different layers and levels that what one reader recognizes, another reader might not see, another reader might see something else. And that's why the collaborative effort is so interesting, because in talking about the pieces as we bring them to the table and talking about them, we discover things about them that we hadn't necessarily seen before. And that happens just within our editorial discussions. And then when we bring all of the text material to the design department, we get even more interpretations. And I think that allows us to explore the writing much more thoroughly than if it were just one person picking a story and putting it on the page and putting it out there. we sort of open the doors for readers and allow readers the opportunity to expand their own ability to read.
You probably have staff meetings, but everybody involved, and the design people say, hey, this might be a good image to portray this, or
right,
that sort of thing.
Right, right. And it's very, it has happened every single time that we have taken a story or an essay to the design people. They always come up with something different than what we might have envisioned when we were talking about the story in the English offices. They continually amaze us with their ability to read the stories and present them in a way that we hadn't thought of, but that yet is actually right on and is not as visually kind of literal. So the designers' interpretations of the stories really kind of reach past the surface imagery that you might find in the story to kind of touch on more universal themes, I think. You start to see connections between pieces that you didn't select because of their connections to other pieces. You selected them because of their merit as an individual work. But there are these universal themes, and there's always some kind of zeitgeist going on in contemporary art. There are always themes that are important right now because of where we are right now as a society, and you will see those cropping up in stories that are vastly different structurally and in terms of narrative, in terms of character, but yet they will have these connections that are subtextual. And that's my favorite part of the process, is once we have everything, then sitting down and talking about it and realizing, well, I didn't realize that we had this story that's so different from this story and it's so different from this poem, but yet they're all kind of about the same thing.
Talk about the award, how you found out about it, how you were able to submit for this.
That was kind of I sent in the application when they sent out a call for submissions. We had just joined this organization, the Council of Editors of Learned Journals, and it's a very prestigious organization that's been around forever and has been primarily dedicated to academic journals and is the largest and most respected organization for academic journal publishing, and recently has opened itself up to literary journals and creative journals that are affiliated with English department and language department. So we had recently joined it, and they were having this giving away this award, and so I sent the magazines in just thinking, well, at least I can kind of introduce myself to these people. And I had no idea. I assumed it would be stiff competition because there are so many magazines that are affiliated with it. And I didn't hear anything and it was getting closer and closer to the MLA conference, which is where they would be giving the award away. And I thought, well, if I haven't heard anything by now, somebody else must have won. And the day after, I just thought that to myself, then I got an email from the director of CELJ saying that we had won and that they wouldn't be making an official announcement until the MLA conference. And so, but they wanted me to know that we had won, and hopefully someone from our program could come and represent the magazine to pick up the award. So I did. I went to the conference in DC and picked it up, and it was a wonderful thing. I mean, it's a terrific organization, and some extremely prestigious magazines are involved, and we're on the judging committee, so I was very honored.
Were you able to see some judges' comments or understand what they saw about something that was a little different like this?
Yeah, when they presented the award, the presenters read some comments that they had received from the judges, and they also told us who the judges were, which then it made it even better for me because I recognized many of the names as editors that I really respect of other magazines, and so I was very honored to know that those editors, had singled out Ninth Letter, and many of them said things like the direction that Ninth Letter was taking literary magazines is the right direction. That's the direction that magazines need to go in, moving kind of toward a broader definition of art and literature, and recognizing connections between the visual arts and the written arts. And there are other magazines that are doing that now. We're the first one that sort of dedicated itself to that from the get-go, but There are other literary journals that have been just text-based and been very standard formats that are now experimenting with format. And I'm glad to see that, because I think that for magazines to stay alive as a medium, they have to be willing to change and grow.
Jeff Bossert spoke with Jody Stanley, editor of the award-winning literary journal Ninth Letter. It's a collaboration between the U of I's English department and School of Art and Design. The next issue of this biennial magazine will be out in May. Ninth Letter can be found at a number of bookstores, and it's also available online at ninthletter.com. This is Sidetrack. And now our final student essay, this one from Michael Pitt. He talks about volunteering at a downtown Champaign store and how that job got him thinking about the nature of giving.
Could I have your zip code, please? This is the constant question of the 10,000 Villages volunteer. Right before totaling up a purchase, we record the customer's zip code for sales research. For the past 2.5 years, I've volunteered regularly at the 10,000 Villages on Walnut Street in Champaign, Illinois. So I've become quite adept at entering 5-digit numbers into the computer. 10,000 Villages is a group of stores across North America and Canada that sets up long-term fair trade relationships with artisans in third world countries. Many of these artisan groups subsist entirely on the profits made from the products sold in the stores. Volunteering at 10,000 Villages is charity. Most of the salespeople are volunteers like me, and by giving ourselves freely, we allow the store to keep selling its fairly traded handicrafts from around the world. It's not very hard to volunteer at 10,000 Villages. 4 hours on a Saturday morning each month isn't a very big commitment. The mechanics of the job aren't too demanding either. Mostly I just sit behind the cash register and ring up purchases, occasionally answering a question or helping someone find some specific item. I suppose the ease of my work and my relative distance from those benefited caused me some discomfort. Despite my experience, I'm not really needed at 10,000 Villages. There's no shortage of volunteers. And who says that my presence directly helps those third world artisans? I'm only selling products that they've already been paid for. I realize that it's far more complicated than this, but I'm still moved to question the meaning of charity in general. What makes a great act of charity? Is the homeless man's gift of $20 to a friend in need more or less admirable than Bill Gates' multi-million-dollar donations to charities worldwide? Bill Gates has certainly helped more people than most of us can ever hope to help in our lifetimes, and yet his contribution comes at little or no cost to himself. The homeless man may be giving all the money he has ever owned, but it's unlikely that his small gift will ever be put to any use. Does charity exist in the benefit or the sacrifice? Certainly the benefit is important. If I lock myself in a room without food or water for 3 days, then I have not accomplished much. However, if in doing so I raise $10,000 for orphans, I have done a good deed. Charitable impact seems like it should be the only consideration in determining a giver's worth, because the amount of money or time you give relates directly to the number of people you help. And helping people is what charity is all about. And yet we also honor a great personal sacrifice. Perhaps the most respected charitable organization is the Peace Corps, whose members have pledged nearly all of their time to helping those in need. And some would go as far as to say that Bill Gates is not a generous man, because, despite his massive donations, he still has more money than he'll ever need. We view the donation of a kidney as a great act of charity, because in the most literal sense, the giver is giving of herself. And giving of yourself is what charity is all about. I do not know the answers to these questions. I volunteer at 10,000 Villages because I enjoy sitting behind that cash register, and because I like to think that I'm helping people in need. And despite my misgivings, I probably am helping people in need in some small way. but I think I could do more. Perhaps intent is what really determines an act of charity. I think most of us in the suburban middle class give only so that we do not appear selfish. While our contributions certainly benefit the needy, very few of us have that goal in mind. And I think that until each of us truly desires to help other people, there will be precious few acts of genuine charity.
Michael Pitt is a senior at University Laboratory High School in Urbana. We've been featuring student essays on the program this month. They were done as part of Barb Ridenour's Introduction to Radio class. You're listening to Sidetrack. So you've got the cape, the mask, maybe a secret hideout, and a superpower or two. Now what? Well, two writers are here to help you out. They are Matthew David Brozik and Jacob Sager Weinstein. They have recently published The Government Manual for New Superheroes. It's put out by Anders McMeel Publishing. I talked with them recently and asked them first, what is the number one piece of advice they would give a new superhero?
Sure. Jacob, you want to field this?
Sure. Well, I would say that the single most important thing for a new superhero to know is guard your secret identity with your life. So, for example, if you have business cards that identify you as Captain Mega Man, it should not say Captain Mega Man, a.k.a. John Rogerson, at the bottom.
And Matthew, what would be your advice?
No, I absolutely agree. I knew that Jacob was going to get the right answer. that's exactly what it is. I just some other examples. You should not open, say, a joint checking account with, your secret identity. You shouldn't be like, Marla Mopp with, the executrix with a, right of survivorship. Don't open a bank account in both names.
And also, it's not just you have to sort of keep separate from your secret identity, it's family members. So, for example, if your father is a professional window installer, even if your superhero battle leaves thousands of windows shattered across your city block, you do not want to leave your father's business card with the local business owners.
That's bad form.
Very bad form.
So what prompted you guys to write this book, The Government Manual for New Superheroes?
Probably that... We both wanted to be superheroes, but we just didn't know where to begin. And we kept calling each other and emailing each other, asking each other questions about, adopting a superhero identity, taking a name, picking a costume, a symbol, a logo, and we would just ask each other questions and didn't have any answers. So we realized there was a need for this manual, and we were the guys to write it, even though we didn't have any of the answers.
We figured that there must just be hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of guys like us out there who would be out at this moment wearing skin-tight spandex and beating up evildoers if only they had the information they needed.
And women.
And, oh yes, especially women.
Guys and gals, especially women. Billions of women.
Did you guys read a lot of comic books growing up?
I've never read a comic book.
Really?
I'm reading comic books right now.
What about you, Jacob?
I had the requisite geeky childhood. So yes, lots of text adventure games and lots of comic books.
But I mean, because the reason I ask is the image of the superhero that you guys portray in here is that classic 1950s Silver Age superhero, the one who has the mask and the secret hideout and the sidekicks. These are the classic do-gooders.
Exactly. Well, we based that on my father.
But, I mean, superheroes nowadays are much more brooding and darker heroes.
Well, we do talk a little bit about that. And sort of in the section early on in the book, we talk about choosing your persona. And you have to choose whether you're going to be a flag-waving do-gooder or a dark and brooding creature of the night.
The problem is, or really the angle that we chose, the government is not as much a fan. Like, I'll just come right out and say it. Not as much a fan of the brooding superhero as the do-gooding, more happy-go-lucky type, because the happy-go-lucky type is more likely to fill out the requisite forms and pay the required taxes and franchise fees. And that's really the personality the government prefers.
Yeah, very very few brooding Avengers have accountants.
So why do you think that this idea of the superhero still fascinates us as a culture? It's very popular still. There's a lot of big movies coming out. A lot of big movies have come out. It's the big summer blockbuster goldmine is the superhero movie.
Well, I think that, they always say that what we look for in art is truth and a representation of ourselves. And so based on that, I just have to assume that so many of us are sort of chipper orphan newspaper boys and brooding multimillionaire industrialists that we want to see our daily life portrayed in full realism on the screen. I guess it also could be wish fulfillment if you want a crazy theory.
Right. Well, I mean, let's go back to the movies there. You know, those are the big things right now. And this summer we've got a few more coming out. The Return of the Superman movie, Superman Returns.
Superman Returns, right.
And another X-Men movie. Have you guys had a favorite movie so far?
Ooh. I love both the X-Men films.
And those are dark, brooding characters.
Some of them.
Yeah.
Possibly the best superhero movie ever was the recent Batman Begins, and that, again, is a pretty dark, brooding character.
Well, but then again, well, movies, you don't see a lot of movies with just really happy people,
There has to be conflict.
Based on conflict. And
yeah.
True.
And drama.
Which I guess would go the same for the comic books as well. Any sort of narrative needs conflict.
So who is your favorite superhero, Matthew?
Spider-Man.
Definitely.
No question. Always has been. Always will be Spider-Man.
And because?
That's a very good question. I think he's got the most interesting powers and abilities. And I guess like most people, I fall into that category of people who like him because his alter ego, Peter Parker, is just a regular guy. Actually, he's probably more troubled, or at least historically had more troubles than just your regular guy. And his life is even worse than mine. So, it's sort of a pleasure to read about someone who gets these abilities, and then it doesn't even improve his life. It makes it worse. And people don't even really look up to him as a hero. In large part because of J. Jonah Jameson constantly putting him down and casting this light on him like, hey, this is a bad guy. So the guy just can't win. I don't know why that makes him my favorite.
Jacob?
When I think about it, that's just depressing.
I guess we do look for superheroes for a slice of life realism after all.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, I'm a loser, so I can only read loser comics.
So, Jacob, who's your favorite?
My favorite superheroes are my mom and dad, and I say that because I know that Matthew's parents will hear that and say, why can't you be more like that nice co-author of yours? Did Spider-Man carry you in his body for 9 months?
My father, for the record, did not carry me anywhere. Not for 9 months. And also for the record, my parents don't listen to these interviews. I don't let them.
I've been sending them taped copies, actually.
wonderful. That's why they don't speak to me anymore.
So if there was one superhero out there who is in desperate need of a makeover, and you guys could help, who would that be?
That's a great question.
That's a really good question. At one point, certainly, it would have been Batman, but the movies have done a great job of sort of making him over. Matthew, why don't you answer that one?
Yeah, that's very funny. possibly Green Lantern, if only for the white gloves. I'm just killing time here. I'm buying time so Jacob can think of something. Maybe. But the thing is, Green Lantern is so powerful that he really doesn't need to get his hands dirty. So he's the only superhero who could wear white gloves and get away with it.
Well, I mean, speaking of too powerful, I think that to some degree Superman, the classic problem is that because he doesn't really have clearly defined powers other than being able to do anything better than anybody, they keep adding powers to him, and it gets harder and harder for them to figure out actual obstacles to him. And then every 10 years or so, they sort of go back to the basics and strip away all his powers, and then it starts all over again.
Hey, you know what? He doesn't need a cape. Superman does not need a cape.
But then he's not Superman.
What? Does his power come from the cape?
If he doesn't have a cape, then what is going to flap dramatically behind him as he stands atop a building?
Exactly, but it's going to get destroyed because only his cape can be destroyed because it's not touching his skin. So he doesn't need it. Superman should get rid of the cape. There's our answer, Superman.
Now that you guys have written the government manual for new superheroes, is there going to be a follow-up book?
Yes. In fact, there is.
Okay.
It's the government manual for new wizards.
Oh, I was hoping the government manual or the ungovernment manual for supervillains.
We thought about that, but we just passionately believe in using our great powers for good and not for evil, because with great power comes great responsibility.
Exactly.
As the Spider-Man comic book has told us.
Of course.
That's absolutely right.
And, you know, as agents of the government, it's incumbent upon us only to write encouraging manuals for people who stay on the right side of the law.
Now, of course, if it turned out that one or both of us actually had secret identities as supervillains, they might work counter to the good work we do during the day.
So if people want to find out more about the government manual for new superheroes, where can they go?
The first place to go is to the bookstore to buy the book. And
multiple copies of the book.
Yes, several copies. And yeah, you can only read each copy once.
You could also go to newsuperhero.org, and new superhero is all one word, or you could get it on Amazon as well. It's always possible that your local bookstore is run by a supervillain, in which case it might not have the book, so you'd have to go to Amazon.
Well, Matthew David Brozek and Jacob Sager Weinstein, thank you for joining me today and talking about your book, The Government Manual for New Superheroes. It's published by Andrew McMeel Publishing.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Yes, it's been a pleasure.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and special thanks go out to him this month for his help in recording the student essays. I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.